So, welcome to February, lecture 6, February 2nd, lecture notes page 60. Happy Black History Month to you and yours. Celebrate a month of thinking about Black history. And today happens also to be Groundhog's Day. So, if you follow the important news from the Groundhog, 6 more weeks of winter. Yay. All right. So, mini test 2 closed on schedule on Tuesday. Again, this semester, I'm very impressed with you all. Almost everyone is on deadline and taking their tests on time. This is phenomenal. It never happens. So give yourselves a pat on the back. Good jobs. Thank you. Yep, there you go. 89% average. The next one on schedule will open tomorrow morning at 8. Close next Tuesday at 11:59 p.m. covering lectures 5 and 6 from this week. And now we get to the first of the 10 extra credit opportunities. Optional, you want to do it? Great. You don't want to do it? Also great. You're great. I don't care. Well, I care, but you know what I'm saying. Up to you. Two ways to earn that extra credit. Either you stayed with Flashbooks and you have access to McGraw-Hill Connect, and you've already perhaps even been there. You'll see now on the module called Extra Credit, there's a click to go to ELEC, Enhanced Learning Extra Credit 1. It opens tomorrow, but if you click on it, it'll walk you right through over to Connect. You can take that. 3 attempts, keep your high score. It's open for a week till next Thursday, so it's a different schedule than the mini tests. Or if you did not like that route and you decided to go with PackBack, the other way to earn extra credit, you can ask one interesting question and answer 2 interesting questions. If there's not enough people out there posting, I'll post an interesting question, and you can earn your extra credit that way as well. A question?
Do you have to do all of the extra credit assignments to get the extra credit, or can you just do a few?
I'm delighted to have you earn extra credit any way you want it, in any amount you want, doing any number of the 10 that you like. But if you're away 0.3, 0.2, or 0.1, away from the next higher grade at the end of the course, don't come crying to me. Other questions on the extra credit? Okay. Believe it or not, people say that they find it interesting, rather than just hearing me blather on or just taking the test, that's an interesting other way to get the material. So you might try it if you're still part of Flashbook, see if you like it. Other questions? Web students, any questions? You're good? Thank you. All right. I can't get away from M&M's. There keep being follow-up stories. Now I can't get away from Johnson's and Johnson's. No sooner did I post this for you on Tuesday than this came back up. So we remember that Johnson's and Johnson's was using, I didn't give the title to it then, but it's called the Texas Two-Step Bankruptcy Ploy is what it's called. And that's the idea where you move all of your liabilities into a division, into a new company, and then that new company goes bankrupt. And so you aren't tied up for years and years in court. So a federal appeals court panel has voted unanimously to dismiss Johnson & Johnson's attempt to use the controversial Texas two-step strategy to resolve claims from users who allege that the company's talc products cause cancer. That's what we said last time about it. The ruling from the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals prevents J&J from funneling approximately 40,000 lawsuits into its newly created subsidiary, LTL Management, and declaring it bankrupt, a ploy that could save the company billions. In a statement, J&J said it will challenge the ruling. So legal issues and business, legal being one of those external factors, the CREST factors, competition, regulation, legal and political, economic, social, and technology that impacts our lives as business people. This I thought was interesting because we just got done talking about age cohorts and targeting them, and this is 20 brands that are gaining popularity with Gen Z. In a sign of economic times, discount supermarket chain Aldi. How many of us know Aldi? Is that a brand we know? We do. Aldi is gaining ground with younger consumers. Aldi tops the latest Ad Age Harris Poll Gen Z brand tracker at number 1, which ranks brands that gained the most attention from Gen Z in the fourth quarter of last year. They run this regularly, this research. So here's the idea of marketing research, and it's on the topic of age cohorts and what they like. An Aldi rep said, "We know our unique shopping experience resonates with Gen Z, many of whom are seeking quality, affordability, alternatives to pricier name brands. Over the past year, we've identified ways to share the Aldi difference through channels that reach our new Gen Z fans. That includes a TikTok account, which the brand launched in June. So we're reaching our target audience with value that appeals to them through channels, through media channels that they go to. Number two on the list is the WNBA. It made headlines related to the coverage of how Brittany Griner was detained in February 2022 in Russia. That appealed to the sensitivities and the values of the interest of Gen Z as well. Automakers accounted for five of the top 20 brands that appealed to Gen Z in the poll. BMW is fourth, Volvo fifth, Subaru seventh, Cadillac 17th, and Mini Cooper 19th. This has to do with how EVs are driving a lot of momentum with Gen Z. For example, getting attention, BMW-owned Mini Cooper hyped its EVs in November by launching a new white paint finish. Wow, that's exciting, a new white paint finish. But they got consumers involved. They got people to vote during International Polar Bear Week, ask the consumers to name the paint color and the polar bear mascot that was associated with the campaign. So they got attention with the Gen Zers. That sort of gets your attention all by itself. White, which is what it turned out to be, with over 50,000 subscribers on that YouTube channel. So that turned out to be favorable for them. And several alcohol beverages brands got Gen Z's attention last quarter, including High Noon Hard Seltzer and two vodka brands, New Amsterdam and Pinnacle Vodka, according to the poll. Alcohol seems to benefit as more Gen Zers come of legal drinking age. Well, duh. So here's the impact of changing demographics on tastes and on marketing. I'm unlikely to test you on all 20, but I thought you might like to see what that top 20 list looked like. So we see Audi, WNBA, Blue Bunny, BMW, Volvo, Honeycomb, Subaru, L'Oreal, Discovery Plus, and Gap in the top 10. And Gap used to be one of my favorite stores to talk about, one of those favorite chains with all their various approaches. Then they were sort of suffering pretty badly. Gap was not doing well. It's nice to see they're back in the top 10 here. Apparently they're picking up a little bit with the Gen Zers, along with the other list, including Joanne. How many of you guys have been to a Joanne store? Where are they headquartered? Hudson, Ohio. Right, a local Ohio connection. Thank you. So that's the list. Finally, how many of you guys like spicy foods in general? How about Tabasco in particular? Just a couple. All right. Tabasco collaborates with influencer Tinks. Anybody know Tinks for any reason? You know Tinks, okay. To reach Gen Z. After seeing a growth in interest from Gen Z, Tabasco is launching its first ever product collaboration with an influencer, a jalapeno dressing. Jalapeno dressing, inspired by TikTok creator Christina Najjar, also known as Tinks. So we're tracking consumer interest, what's going on out there. We're targeting an age cohort. Gen Z is interested. And here's the importance of social media to marketing. Tinks is into this whole product category. The dressing is the culmination of several years of interacting with Tinks, who's made it known to her 1.5 million TikTok fans that she loves Tabasco, specifically the green jalapeno flavor. The dressing, which went on sale yesterday, will only be available online through Amazon. So we're seeing new product introduction. We'll talk about new products later. And channel of distribution decision. We're going only through Amazon for now. The brand started interacting with Tinks on social media in 2021, drawn to her motto of normalize hot sauce as dressing. Late last year, they had her visit Tabasco's factory on Avery Island in Louisiana. So we're seeing a social media influencer at work for our brand. Tinks' brand deals typically include high-end brands, such as Clay de Peau Beauty, Victor and Rolf Fragrances, Lacoste, and Fresh Beauty. Tabasco may not carry the higher price tags of such previous partners, but the partnership shows how a creator's authentic brand passion, she really liked the idea of Tabasco as dressing, can make a collaboration ring true. So we see a bit about authenticity in marketing.
Tinks here. Tabasco asked for a behind-the-scenes look at my dressing room.
So come on in.
Anyone who knows me knows I am obsessed with all things green.
Shoes green, bags green,
Tabasco green,
cheap.
I have a confession to make. I've been hiding something from you.
Ready?
Tabasco made my dreams come true.
Tabasco, Tanks,
avocado, jalapeno, hot sauce dressing. Obsessed.
No more sad salads. Zesty, herby, dreamy, with just that perfect amount of spice. How did we even live before this? It's everything. Guys, this is a limited edition collab available only online. Go on. What are you waiting for?
Did you feel like you're visiting an old friend, Tinks, on TikTok? Well, that wasn't it. It also helps that hot sauce is trending among younger consumers. In 2020, the hot sauce market was valued around $2.75 billion. That's a lot of bottles of hot sauce, but is projected to reach nearly $5 billion by 2026, according to a recent report by Facts and Factors. The Tabasco segment of the market is projected to grow the fastest in that time period. So marketing research at work, tracking changing consumer tastes over time. Gen Z and millennials are most likely to prefer hot, extra hot, and extremely hot spice levels in dips and sauces compared to other generations. Instead of just putting it in their chili or on their eggs, they're far more experimental. So understanding the consumer age cohort preference. Over the last 2 years, Tabasco has shifted focused away from platforms such as Instagram and Twitter to go to TikTok. The explosion of social media has given us a way to talk to folks engaging with hot sauce. Tabasco currently has 520,000 TikTok followers. So we see Tabasco choosing their media to reach their consumers. And with hot sauce being popular among younger consumers and seeing Tinks organically talk about the brand, it has made the partnership a natural extension of both of their entities. Cool. So pick up with lecture notes, page 60 and page 80 in the textbook, continuing with chapter 3, understanding those external factors. So last time we were talking about the T of the Crest factors, technology. I think we left off here. Electronic business technology and the impact of COVID-19. For retail, e-commerce is arguably the most significant retail digital transformation ever. COVID-19 forced retailers to invest more money into new technologies and implement those technologies much more quickly than otherwise they had planned to do. And retailers that had not yet started to sell online have quickly transformed their businesses. The coronavirus accelerated e-commerce growth trends significantly. U.S. e-commerce penetration jumped to more than 25% in April of 2020 from 15% at year-end 2019. So this impact of this pandemic through technology dragged a lot of retailers forward several years in terms of their adoption of technology to reach consumers. So here's digital channels used for the first time due to COVID-19. These are a percentage of respondents from survey of 2,600 decision makers at enterprise level companies. So this is company use, live chat, interactive voice response, video voice, in-app chat, SMS, web chat bot, down to their website and messaging app, because a lot of them had already been using it, so it wasn't their first time. So just some info on that. So what does this little thing is A, funnier if it works when I click it. We'll see, because my clicks don't always work. Second is funnier. A few years ago, we'll see if you guys know who this business expert is, what he's doing, and you'll realize his advice on how he can use technology. We'll see if it works. Yeah, there we go. Way funnier when it works. Try it one more time.
Okay, well, we can do questions. Okay, very good. First hand up.
Sir, as a company that primarily distributes paper, how have you adapted your business model to function in an increasingly paperless world?
We can't overestimate the value of computers. Yes, they are great for playing games and forwarding funny emails, but real business is done on paper, okay? Write that down.
So, who's the expert here? Nobody knows him at all. Michael?
Michael Scott.
Scott of a fictional paper company. right? Dunder Mifflin, so from the TV show The Office. You guys know The Office or no? So here Michael Scott is being asked by his intern to go to his MBA class and talk about business. He's talking about technology. And what's he say? Well, you know, sure, computers are out there, but business is done on paper. Write that down. We shift over to the MBA students, and what are they all doing? Typing on their computer. My point, I guarantee you, you'll run in your life into a manager somewhere who looks out from the business, sees the environment, sees a trend happening, and says, yeah, but let's not worry about it, like Michael Scott is doing with computers, right? It happens. We're trying to recommend that you don't simply ignore those trends as you see them happening. You ask what it means for you, yeah? So watching those trends are important. Now, because we're talking about paper, it is an old product category, but that doesn't mean they aren't moving along. So in the real world of paper, here's AstroBrites. Imagination comes boldly to life with AstroBrites paper, ideal for use at work, home, and schools. Choose from among 23 vibrant colors in a variety of sizes, weights, and assortments. Let your ideas soar with the possibility of AstroBrites. So even in an old category like paper, they're still doing exciting things, just not high tech. Competition is another crest factor, a factor outside your firm that's going to impact your world, impact your consumers, and impact you. So competition is other firms or organizations or people that would love to take your customers or clients away from you. How? By providing better need satisfaction than you do, can, or care to do. You're making money. They would like some of that money. You aren't able to, don't care to, don't want to satisfy your consumers better, we'll take them over from you. Now, your success, when you're thinking about this, comes from finding a better way to satisfy consumers. It comes from a competitive advantage over those companies you want to be, not from your, quote, need to be competition. The need to be competition is the wrong focus. Finding ways to better satisfy their consumers is the right focus to get this done against competition. So what kinds of competition do we talk about? Well, there is pure competition. Pure competition is a situation we have a large number of sellers. They're all selling pretty similar products. We would say commodity products, not much differences among them. And so distribution is very important. Anybody remember from maybe micro econ? What's a good example of pure competition where you have many sellers of very similar products? Standard sort of example. Down a step from bread is wheat, barley, those sorts of things. So agricultural products. I mean, what is your favorite brand of wheat? I don't buy wheat. It's a commodity product, right? So agricultural products, corn, wheat, soybeans. And the notion here is you have a huge number of farmers out there. They don't do a lot of individual marketing for their wheat because their wheat's much the same as the other wheat down the road. They have to make sure that they have it in the channel of distribution, make it available. Second type of competition is monopolistic competition. In this case, there are a bunch of competitors out there. Typically, no one firm has significant control over the marketplace. The companies in a monopolistic competitive situation produce similar products, as you'll see in a minute, but differentiation is possible. My wheat is pretty much like the guy down the road's wheat. I can't differentiate it. Here, differentiation isn't possible. So we do have a large number of sellers. The products are unique, but even though they're differentiated, we can get some substitution. Pricing becomes important here. Examples include restaurants, cereals, shoes, toilet paper, critically important during the pandemic, as you remember, there was shortage of toilet paper. And so here we have a situation where there are lots of different competitors out there, and one restaurant is different than the other. But if you happen to go downtown and want to go to restaurant A, and they're closed on Thursday afternoons, you can go to another restaurant. They're exchangeable. Is that the kind of competition you're having to deal with? I don't know. Or you could have an oligopoly situation. here, the market out there is dominated by a very small number of big companies. So a few number of large companies have the majority of the market share. There might be a couple sprinkling of smaller companies, but the big ones are the ones that count. The products themselves are relatively similar to one another. And so the promotion, the idea of promotion is very key to demonstrating product differences. Examples include the beer industry. There are really only two major big producers of beer, Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors. What about all those independent little breweries? Well, a lot of those little breweries are actually a subsidiary of one of these two bigger companies. The health insurance market is pretty well run by Anthem and Kaiser Permanente. Where are my video gamers? Video gamers? Anybody a Microsoft gamer? Xbox? Sony, PlayStation, and Nintendo. Okay, and what's left? What's the other big one? That's it. Those are the three. Oligopoly competition. So is that where you find yourself competing? And finally, a pure monopoly. In a pure monopoly, you have a single producer. The thing that they're providing is unique, pretty much unsubstitutable. You can find, stretch the situation to argue sometimes you can substitute, but really not. So here the marketing mix really is not an important factor because you're the only person providing the thing. Microecon example of a pure monopoly? Viagra? Well, actually, that's now because, first of all, I don't want to talk about Viagra with you. Second, what do you know? Second of all, it's actually gone generic by now. So there's actually, yeah. I'd be happy to bring you my script if you want to see it. So yeah. So they're not, they've now gone more generic. Other more classic example? Well, I don't know why he gave that. I'll go talk to him about his situation. When he talked about it, it was perhaps the unique lock on it. Which one? Oh, interesting. I think insulin may have gone generic too, but the one I'm more used to are utilities, where you have, where else are you going to buy water if not from the water company? Assuming you're on city water, where are you going? Who's the second choice? Or electricity or natural gas? These are utilities, single producer usually in your area. What are you going to substitute? It's hard to substitute, and so marketing mix is not very important. In fact, sometimes they demarket. They advertise, use less electricity because we don't want to build any more power plants. It's too expensive. Okay? What is the form of competition that you exist in? We can go along the continuum here looking at the number of sellers, the product differences, and the importance of the marketing mix. So pure competition, things like farm products, there's a large number of sellers, the products are very similar, so distribution is key. Monopolistic competition, restaurants, toothpaste might fit in there, large number of sellers, unique but substitutable products, pricing is important. Oligopoly, video games, consoles, very few large competitors, similar products, promotion is key to explain those product differences, and then a monopoly with a single producer. Unique and unsubstitutable products, so marketing mix just is not that important to them. Now, as you think about this issue of competition, why do you have to worry about it? Can't everybody just buy everything? And of course, that's silly. The answer is no. People can't just buy everything. Why not? They have limited resources. So as they think about those limited resources, those limited buying power, we recognize that there are various companies out there competing for those dollars, yeah? I mean, it's obvious, I guess. But they compete at different levels. They compete for dollars at the brand level. So here we have the idea of brand competition where we are competing for consumers' dollars at the same type of product. So Colgate toothpaste competes at the brand level against things like Procter & Gamble Crest, Church & White, Complete Care, Arm & Hammer, toothpaste, brand-level competition. We have to worry about that, obviously. But that's not the only thing that consumers worry about spending their dollars on. We also have to recognize that we compete for dollars at the product level, where we're selling products that can be substitutes for one another. So I might buy Cleveland baseball season tickets for my entertainment dollars. What else might I spend my entertainment dollars on? Well, it's not another baseball team in Cleveland, right? So that's not it. I'm not worried about that level. What else might I spend my entertainment dollars on, say, in Cleveland? The Cavs. Okay, so I might do basketball. What else? Might do football. What else?
Might read a book.
Well, read a book or moving to that whole other series of things. Right, I could be spending my money on the, I don't know, is there an opera series, on the theater series, on, right? Buying books. So, I have to worry across the orchestra, streaming, book reading. So across that level, it's not one substitute, it's not one brand against another brand, but people are deciding how to spend their entertainment dollars. And in a recession, they're more likely to be reading books and watching streaming than they are going to be buying season tickets. What about that level of competition for your consumers' dollars? And finally, we have the idea at the company level. So consumers are deciding whether to buy sporting goods or clothing, or transportation, or donating to charities. What are your consumers' decision-making involved? What sorts of brands, what sort of products, what sort of companies are they considering? Obviously, you have to know a lot about them. So how is your firm going to successfully compete against this competition? Well, the answer is you need to have a differential advantage. Sometimes we call this your unique selling proposition. If you went out of business, would anybody care? Would anybody miss you? Let me say, if the answer is no, because you're the same as everybody else, good luck staying in business. Having gained this differential advantage over your competition, you got to maintain it. What do I mean? Environmental factors are changing, consumer tastes are changing, competition is changing, technology is changing. You've got to keep it up. You're busy people making it happen.
From food?
So this is an interesting case where an industry resisted change. They weren't going to change. They knew what they were, and they're not making any changes. Whoops, whoops, the market's moving away from me. Maybe I should make a change.
From food to wine. Italy has finally signed on to the global trend toward wine in a box. That's right, the Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry has authorized producers to package some wines in non-glass containers. Ray Isle is deputy wine editor for Food and Wine magazine. He joins us from New York. Thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
It sounds like this was a long debate in Italy. What finally changed their minds?
Well, many things are a long debate in Italy.
Yes.
What finally changed their minds, I think, was a realization that they weren't going to be able to compete in a global market, which is what wine has become, without changing some of these traditional restrictions they have on regional wines. Because box wine is without any question a wave of the future. I mean, its percentage of the wine market keeps increasing with every passing year. What's interesting is that the real shift has been towards higher end box wine, and this is exactly what this Italian decision represents. What you won't see are wines like Brunello di Montalcino, Barolo, Chianti Classico, which are truly the most famous Italian wines. You will see wines like Rosso Canero, Dolcetto d'Alba, Rosso di Montalcino, wonderful wines, just not the absolute premier top of the heap.
What are the numbers here? How much of a demand is there now?
Well, there's a tremendous demand for boxed wine. You know, in some markets, like in Northern Europe, let's say, where Italy does sell a lot of wine, you know, it may be 50% of the market.
Okay.
In the U.S., I forget where it is exactly, but I think it's in the sort of 9 to 12% at this point and growing rapidly. And one thing, you know, one reason that boxes are immensely popular with wine producers is that they're much cheaper than bottles. It's about a, you know, factor of 10 to 1 in terms of packaging cost.
Is there no downside, no weird aftertaste from that bag?
Well, you wouldn't want to do it for a wine that you're going to age over time. You would eventually, I can only assume, get some kind of chemical interaction between the polyethylene bag that's in the inside the box and the wine itself. So definitely wouldn't want to put your first growth Bordeaux in a bag inside a box. But for, you know, a kind of wonderful, you know, juicy, friendly Dolcetto Alba, why not? And what you're also going to start seeing are Tetra Paks, which are like juice boxes.
Don't tell the Italians.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope once you start on this box thing. You'll find your wine in all sorts of containers. I got an aluminum tube full of wine the other day at work. Sort of an interesting twist.
What are these Tetra Paks like?
Tetra Paks, if you think of a juice box and then expand it to a 1 liter size, it's similar to a box of wine, except that it doesn't have the plastic bag inside. So it's really like it's almost like a milk carton of wine. They're very, eco-friendly. They're recyclable. They have, much less of a carbon footprint. You can flatten them out once you're done with them. And the virtue that a box has over a Tetra Pak is that inside that plastic bag, there's no air. And when you open the spigot and pour yourself a glass of wine, the bag shrinks down as the wine goes out, and there's never any air in it. So the wine actually lasts quite a bit longer than something like a bottle or a Tetra Pak. You can have, open your box of Rosso di Montalcino, and 3 weeks later, it'll still be good.
No straw on that Tetra Pak?
Believe it or not, I think I did see an Australian Tetra Pak wine that did have a straw come with it.
Those which, Australians.
The Australians, whatever the trend is, they're going to be out way in front of it.
Well, Ray Isle, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks very much.
Ray Isle is deputy wine editor for Food and Wine magazine.
Please bring me a box of your finest wine and 2 straws. Have anybody ever had wine from a box? How's it taste? Tastes like wine. So, Italy says, hey, we're not putting our wine out in boxes. We're Italy. We're doing bottles. Well, wait a minute. 50% of the market is bought. Maybe we should change our idea because we're losing market share to these folks that are using a different approach. Yeah? And indeed, it's continued. So, Noon Wine Packaging 2018, innovation in packaging seems to be well accepted by Americans with 49% growth weight of wine in cans. 37% growth wine on tap, 18.5% Tetra Pak, 15.2% box, 7.5% plastic. And considering that most of these containers, with the exception of box wine, are relatively new to the U.S. market in the past few years, though available in other countries for decades, this is pretty amazing. So this trend has spread from Europe here. I may or may not have mentioned my wife, who is a bit of a Francophile. She likes to spend time in Paris. Who doesn't? And so one time she was there for, a month, and I came over for a couple weeks. We go to the local grocery store. You bring in your own container, set it under the grocery store spigot, and add your wine, because wine is a regular part of the meal, to your personal container, and then check out that way. I don't think we have that here yet, but maybe it's coming too. Point. You got to keep up with the changes of competition if they're taking away your consumers, and indeed, they were. Oh, there was a 2020 update. Cans and convenience are very important with outdoor activities on the rise and desire for more convenience. Wine in cans, Tetra Paks, and plastic containers will continue to grow in the U.S. market. In 2020, canned wine actually grew 61% in dollar growth, causing a can shortage in the supply chain. Small bottles and large box formats also gained in popularity with 375 millimeter growing at 53% in value, the 3 liter boxes, 31% value growth. That's some pretty good growth. This is an area ripe for innovation as packaging designers try to figure out new and attractive ways to sell wines in boxes, cans, Tetra Paks, and plastic containers. So, lots of excitement in the wine packaging industry. Also then, we have that factor that I call regulatory, political, and legal, CREST. And there's a whole list of things here. You can read about the details in the book, and eventually you may take a business law course here. But monetary and fiscal policy, going to be really big with this change in the Senate in terms of who's in power. And we know that Republicans in general are more on tightening budgets, oversight, making sure there's no waste in the general economy. Well, eventually that's going to filter down and influence your business perhaps as well. Social legislation and regulation, anti-pollution, etc. Regulate to competition, that's going to vary, preventing monopolies, constrained trade issues, and consumer protection. So what's going on with the latest administration? How does that influence you? Lots of other things out there. Read about them in the book, because there's lots of laws that could apply. So what are some trends here? The U.S. economy is, of course, expected to slow. We know inflation is an issue. What did the Fed just do this week? The Fed? The banking system? Nobody? Thank you. Who am I talking to? They raised interest rates once again, but not by 5 points, but by 0.25, whatever, 0.25%. So indeed, inflation is not gone yet, but they've lowered the increase in the interest rates. How does that affect car loans, house loans, credit cards, etc.? It's all going to come back and influence us, right? Federal Reserve continues to tighten monetary policy, and if inflation is more persistent than expected, the Fed will need to tighten more, which will further slow the economy and influence our consumers and us. Most workers' wages have failed to keep up with inflation, eroding the purchasing power of households. So remember, we talked previously about the economy and economic factors. We said, how much discretionary income do they have? That factor is in part influenced by these decisions. The odds of the U.S. economy falling into recession this year are greater than 50%. Consumer spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of total gross domestic product, is projected to barely grow in the middle half of the year. I think you know this, but maybe you don't. 66% of the economy is you guys spending money, not the government spending money. So when sometimes we say, well, why can't the government just take care of this? Because you aren't, or are, but you're not spending money, so the economy sinks. They can't just fix it. They only control a third of the economy, which maybe you know. So the question is, what is all this going to mean for you, your business, for marketers? All right. So that is the end of Chapter 3, thinking about these external factors. An important element in doing business in general and in marketing in particular is the issue of ethics. And I wish I didn't have to spend time talking about it, because I wish that people simply did ethical things because it's the right thing to do, you would think. No. This ties in the idea of corporate social responsibility in general, sustainability, ethics, social responsibility, sincerity, long-term customer relationships, how we spend our resources. Notes page 65, ethical and social responsibility in marketing, one of our key learning objectives. So how many of you guys have had a course in ethics somewhere along the way, high school or college? Maybe almost a half. Good for you. So ethics in general involves the moral principles and values that guide your actions as an individual. What's your ethical stance? What do you believe is right and true and good? And also the decisions of a group, business people, society at large. So business ethics involves what's right and wrong in the workplace, and then doing right. Unethical business behavior can get you investigated, not so good for your career, fired, less good for your career, jailed, really bad for your career. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal in the classroom, in your personal life, in business. Now, unfortunately, not all management buys in the idea that ethics is important. So we have excuses. Well, why do we need it? Nobody needs ethics because, well, really, ethics is religion, isn't it? It's not business. Or our people are ethical. Don't worry about it till they aren't. Or it's just for philosophers. Or it's obvious, do good. Or it's just being preachy. Or it's just a recent fad. Or ethics can't be managed. Or it's the same as social responsibility. Or if a firm is not in legal trouble, it's being ethical. Or managing ethics has little practical relevance. Maybe, but let's look at some examples where those excuses don't seem to hold up very well. The first example has gotten pretty old, but it's still an interesting one. How many of you guys have heard of Nestle's? We think of them as a pretty good company, pretty ethical, pretty honest company in general. I mean, is that our image of them? Yes, no, we don't have an opinion. So a number of years ago, going back in history a little bit, Nestle's is really big with infant formula, powdered formula. So they decide that there's a growth market for them in Africa. So they decide to do in Africa just what they do in the U.S. Go to the hospitals and prepare a newborn kit for parents. And in part of that kit, there'll be powdered milk, yeah? So you're an African villager, you're going to the big city to get the best care for your soon-to-be-born infant. You get this kit, you take it back to your village, and you say, this is the way modern societies work. Guess I should be using infant formula. To make infant formula work, what do you need to add to it? Water. If you're a poor African villager, what do you suppose you don't have a lot of? Clean water. So now we're adding not very clean water to the infant's formula to feed the kid. Second of all, do we get that for free? We do not. We've got to pay for it. So now we're going to make it stretch by not giving them the full amount. So now we're giving our infants less formula than they should have in polluted water. What is it substituting for? Breast milk. I knew I could turn to you for a little intimate knowledge about how the body works. So breast milk. So what do we have a situation? We're killing off babies in Africa with our product. I'm pretty sure that was not Nestle's intention. But nonetheless, that was their effect. And so people were boycotting. They were upset, as they should be, boycotting Nestle's, getting upset about them. And of course, they stopped doing that. Might have been legal. We aren't too sure it was ethical, as it turned out. Right? Manvel killed off a bunch of people, a bunch of its employees, by continuing to use asbestos long after they knew asbestos was bad. They were, you know, they were sued out of existence and continued to be problematic. Union Carbide killed off thousands of people locally near a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal through bad management of their chemicals. Eventually, it leaked out, killed a bunch of people. Enron, we're going to hear a little bit about Enron from one of our video guest lectures later on. Engaged in conflicts of interest, Ken Lay, who presided over the Enron accounting scandal, died before serving his prison sentence out. WorldCom and MCI, I think we'll hear about them later too, inflated their accounting reports. So here we are trying to compete against WorldCom MCI. We can't, man, because they're looking so good, they were lying about how they were doing. Bernard Evers of WorldCar served half his prison term for fraud, dying shortly after his early release. Martha Stewart is the one that puzzles me. You all know she was tried, accused, tried, convicted of insider trading. We know this. She was guilty. She gets done with her sentence and returns to be a very successful businesswoman today. So she's still running a successful business. There's an example where I guess it's okay to lie, cheat, and steal. I don't know. You know Bernie Madoff? Basically, you know that story, right? So Bernie, actually it's a great story, I think on Netflix right now, about Madoff, runs an investment scheme that's essentially entirely a pyramid scheme. He's taken money and money and money from major individuals, other companies, investment firms, cities, retirement funds, and just spending it all down. It's all gone. There's no investment, even though he lies to you about investments. He eventually is jailed, you know, accused, convicted, jailed. Of course, he went bankrupt. He died in 2021. He was serving a 150-year prison sentence. His kid, one of his two kids, committed suicide. Consequences for these actions. Anybody remember the, Volkswagen cheated on their emission tests. So every time you went to check on how their emissions coming out of their cars were, they were always low. They had software that cheated the system. They were busted to the tune of almost $15 million. Anybody hear about the Fry Festival? Okay, this was Billy McFarland creates a fantastic weekend event, 3 or 4 days on an island, and you're going to be there with gorgeous people and celebrities, and there's going to be music. It's going to be terrific. He creates a fantastic set of promotional videos for this non-existent.
I actually just broke up with my boyfriend this morning.
Sorry to hear that.
Oh, dude.
All right, for this
the actual experience exceeds all expectations and is something that's hard to put in words. All these things that may seem big and impossible are not. It gives people that type of energy, that type of power.
An immersive music festival, 2 weekends, beautiful people, a remote island, holy mackerel, sign me up. He didn't have any of that stuff, actually. There was an island, things exist. There was some stuff on it, like huts and stuff. And he sold this thing, I forget how much money he made on it. He was busted. It was a complete fraud. He was sentenced to serve 6 years in federal prison. In October 2018, in 2022, he's released from federal prison custody and moved to a halfway house. Wells Fargo, open fraudulent customer accounts. They had a $185 million fine. $5 million were refunded to customers. Thousands of their employees were laid off. They had to find a way to recover from that, so they ran a series of ads on recovering
from
it.
We know the value of trust. We were built on it. Back when the country went west for gold, we were the ones who carried it back east. By steam, by horse, by iron horse. Over the years, we built on that trust. We always found the way. Until we lost it. But that isn't where the story ends. All it's right. Where it starts again. With a complete recommitment to you. Yeah. Fixing what went wrong, making things right, and ending product sales goals for branch bankers. So we can focus on your satisfaction. We're holding ourselves accountable to find and fix issues proactively. Because earning back your trust is our greatest priority. It's a new day at Wells Fargo, but it's a lot like our first day. Wells Fargo, established 1852, reestablished 2018.
Wow, that sounds good. You're reestablishing your reasons for me to trust you and be faithful to you. And stunningly, in December 2022, Wells Fargo was ordered to pay $3.7 billion for illegal activity, including unjust foreclosures and vehicle repossessions. What the heck, Wells Fargo? Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal, for goodness sakes. What are you doing? What are you doing? And more, the founder and CEO, John Kapoor, and four top executives of the pharmaceutical custom company, Insys, were found guilty in a scheme involving bribes and kickbacks to physicians who prescribed large amounts of a fentanyl spray to patients who did not need the painkiller. He's serving a 5.5-year prison sentence. Elizabeth Holmes, founder and CEO of the failed blood testing company, Theranos, was sentenced to 11 years and 3 months in federal prison for her role in committing a years-long fraud. Her product was claimed to, with a drop of blood, analyze 57 different conditions. It was fake. It was a lie. What are you doing? What are you doing? Take my course, please. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. All right. We do get ourselves in troubles, even big companies that we've seen. Nike has been criticized in a variety of different ways over time. They've been criticized for not being especially socially responsible with what they do. They've been accused of using sweatshops to make their products with child labor overseas. And not just using children, but putting their employees in horrible working conditions. They've been accused of targeting low-income families by making their shoes an expensive status symbol for poor urban street kids who can't afford them and then engage in bad activity to get them. So they've engaged in some corrective behavior. For example, they've created a code of conduct for themselves, their employees, their supply chain partners, a six-point plan that ensures more socially responsible labor practices. They've commissioned an independent study of Nike factories around the world. Here's a bit of their code of conduct. Commitment is everything, our expectations, our vision for a collaboration. We want to be safe, fair, respected, and sustainable. This is what they tell their people. They created a huge social responsibility department. They publish a corporate responsibility report to let people know regularly what they're doing. So here's their social responsibility and a bunch of stuff about how they're being socially responsible. And the Nike Foundation works to create positive social change around the world by getting kids up, active, and running around. So we're breaking barriers. Purpose guides us. There's a letter from the boss. And here's a bunch of stuff we're doing. So, yeah, we haven't always been perfect, but also we're trying to be better, would be a way to view it. So if you had a course in philosophy, in ethics, perhaps, you talked about the idea of things being legal or illegal, and things being ethical or unethical, creating this little two-by-two, and then we get to the question of how should we think about these if we're in, say, business. So, can you think, it doesn't have to be in business for now, but can you think of something that might be ethical but illegal? Can you think of anything in the world like that? Ethical, yeah.
Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, we would argue, the mythical character in jolly old England. His people were being overtaxed by the Nottingham sheriff and the bad, who was the king? Richard the something? Doesn't matter. Not Richard, that was the Lionhearted. And John, King John. And so Robin Hood stole from the rich. That's illegal, but for good reasons. He gave to the poor. Okay? So, is there anything in business where we might do something that's ethical but illegal? Is that something we would ever consider? Do you have something in mind? You look like you were about to volunteer something that would be ethical but illegal in business.
Potentially funding like protests?
Perhaps. So where are protests? I've got to think if it's illegal anywhere. Maybe in another country where it would be illegal. All right. Unethical and illegal. Look, if it's unethical and illegal, I have a great idea for you. If it's unethical and illegal, how about you just don't do it? We shouldn't have to have a lot of discussion about that. If it's ethical and legal in business, we might say, well, it could be okay. Does it fit with our strategic plan? Does it fit with our mission, with our goals, with what our consumer wants, with what our competition is doing? But that's okay. So it's over here in the question where something might be ethical but illegal. Should we ever do that? And we have this idea of something that's unethical but legal. How about just a life situation of something that's unethical but legal? How many of you guys came from a high school where it had zero tolerance for any kind of drug thing at all? So literally, if you had aspirin in your purse and your friend had a headache, you better not give them an aspirin or inhaler or whatever, because you've broken our code. That would be technically, I guess that's an example of ethical but illegal in the school, I guess. Unethical but legal. I go in and buy a company in a small town. It's mine. I decide to shut it down. I don't need it. But that company employs 85% of the people in the town. Is it legal for me to do that? Probably. Is it ethical? Might ask myself, how's that going to play out in the press? Should I really be doing that? So there are situations where things are ethical but illegal, or unethical but legal, where perhaps you should ask yourself, how are we going to decide on this? What's the decision-making process? Should Johnson & Johnson take all of those liabilities, put them in a company, and cause it to go bankrupt? Initially, I thought it was illegal. Now they're arguing over whether it's legal or not. It's certainly not very ethical, though, right? Should we do that? How's it going to play out for us? So what decision-making process do you have at those corporate levels that's making those decisions to recognize where it sits and how you're going to deal with it, how you're going to think about it? Marketing does get criticized, sometimes legitimately, sometimes not, for what some people consider ethical lapses. For example, high prices caused by marketing, deceptive practices, high-pressure sales, shoddy, harmful, or unsafe products, planned obsolescence, poor service to disadvantaged consumers. And the reason we get criticized for these things is arguably it has a negative impact on our consumers, it has a negative impact on society as a whole, it has a negative impact on other businesses. You're cheating. They can't trust you. You're not doing things honestly. Anybody have a good old Uncle Charlie that comes to Thanksgiving and he's anti-business? Everything marketing does is wrong. Anybody have somebody like that in their family at all? No? So there is a set of people who, man, business is just bad. Capitalism is bad. Marketing is bad. Some of these things, by the way, are wrong. Some we can talk about. So let's look at some of these things. So some people argue that prices for goods are higher than they should be because of those darn marketers. So prices are boosted up because there's high cost of distribution, and those people in the channel of distribution take markups, and that drives costs up. But consumers want utility that comes with that. Consumers want convenience. They want a store open 24/7 by them. They want lots of assortment. They don't want to go to a store that only sells one thing. They want easy return privileges. Somebody's got to help pay for that. High prices can be caused by high advertising and high promotion. That's where marketing in particular gets blamed for things. But how many of us like particular brands? We like Heineken, we like Levi's, we like Coca-Cola, we like Harrods, we like those, Nike, we like those brands. Yes, I want that brand. The reason we know that that brand is somebody advertises it, somebody promotes it, and you're willing to pay for it. You do know, of course, that there are generic forms of products, shampoos, soap, aspirin, toothpaste. Now, it's not really fair to ask you this because y'all are college students, but in general, how many of you would prefer, if you had a choice between Bear and the store brand, how many of you are going to buy Bear? It's your health. Yeah, see, it's tough to go. So everybody's going to buy the store brand? I guess because you're college students. Into adulthood, how many of you think you'll still carry that over? You're still going to buy the store brand? How many of you think you might start going for Bear? Okay, so it varies a little bit by the segment we're talking about. But how can Bear even exist? It's $6.49 for its aspirin. The store brand is $2.49. How can they even exist? Some people say, look, I know aspirin is aspirin, but it's my health. I'm worth it. I'm going to buy the more expensive brand. Right? It's a thing. So you can criticize marketers, but there is a choice out there. When we come to things like cancer, and I haven't kept up to date on the latest treatment for cancer, but research shows there are over 200 genes involved with, for example, colon and breast cancers. So we find that tumors from the same organ look different across different patients. And medicines that work in some patients don't work in others. Now, again, medicine is catching up a bit. But the question is, why would any firm spend the money to try to figure all this out if it wasn't going to be able to recover its costs? I need to charge relatively high prices to return my development costs and give me a bit of profit. And if you say, I can't do that, what am I logically going to do as a manufacturer? Not do it. You're not going to let me make a profit. I'm not going to do it. So drug prices can be high. Of course, they can also be crazy high. But I mean high because it costs a lot of money to do this research. Now, can you be unethical? Yes. May 2019, attorneys general for more than 40 states alleged the nation's largest generic drug manufacturers conspired, cheated, worked among themselves to price fix, to artificially inflate and manipulate prices for more than 100 different generic drugs, including treatments for diabetes, cancer, arthritis, and other medical conditions. The lawsuit filed in federal court in Connecticut also names 15 individual senior execs responsible for sales, marketing, and pricing. In 2022, Teva, one of the companies involved, paid out $430 million to settle what's going on. So it's one thing to make a legitimate profit based on your development costs, your expenses, and another thing to fix prices for generic drugs. So one's okey-doke, the other is unethical and illegal. Illegal price fixing. In June 2020, former Bumblebee Foods CEO Chris Lisiski was sentenced to more than 3 years in prison for conspiring to fix prices for canned tuna. Don't fix your prices for canned tuna. You're going to jail. And four poultry industry executives from JBS-owned Pilgrim's Pride and Claxton Poultry were indicted by the Department of Justice on price fixing and bid rigging. Each executive faces a maximum penalty of 4 years in prison and $1 million fine. In 2022, they were acquitted, but in 2020, Pilgrim's Pride agreed to pay $110 million fine. There's legitimate prices, and then there's illegal, unethical prices. So, on the ethical side, on the legal side, high markups that result in higher prices reflect services that customers want and are willing to pay for. Convenience, image, safety, service, return privileges, warranties. And you can either choose or not choose to buy the generic version or what they're offering, but illegal price fixing, a legitimate criticism, is bad and has consequences. Deceptive practices, deceptive pricing, we're sort of alluding to that, but here's the example of falsely advertising factory or wholesale prices or large reductions from phony high retail list prices. Certainly back in the day of the mortgage bubble, They were deceptively selling mortgage rates. So you can't have a sale off of a manufacturer's suggested retail price that's fake. You're lying. Now, some legitimate stores will have a big sale, either in the newspaper or on the web, in their store. It'll say 20% off manufacturer suggested retail price, and the fine print might say, in our stores, this product may never have been sold at the manufactured suggested retail price. It's a little misleading, but it's not totally deceptive. You can read the fine print, right? But just lying about it, that's deceptive. A proposed 2020 class action lawsuit claims that Old Navy lists false or misleading original prices to create the illusion that the items are being sold at discount when they are not. Don't do that. Deceptive promotion, for example, overstating a product's features or performance, running a rigged contest where people don't actually win it. Pfizer was fined $2.3 billion for promoting the sales of Bextra for several uses and dosages that the FDA specifically declined to approve due to safety concerns. Nonetheless, they promoted it for it. That's not legal. That's not good. Be fine. Go to jail as far as I'm concerned. This is bad. The FTC entered into a $22 million settlement with manufacturers of Willow Curve regarding unsubstantiated pain relief claims and deceptive native advertising. So this was a product that was going to relieve your pain. The FTC said that the device that cost between $600 and $800 was deceptively labeled, deceptively marketed, deceptively distributed, and just was not right. So they had a $22 million settlement for that. Don't do that. Deceptive endorsement practices may be met with FTC enforcement, including things like falsely claiming an endorsement by a third party that never actually endorsed your product. That's not right. Misrepresenting whether an endorser is actual, current, or a recent user. Using an endorsement to make deceptive performance claims. You have them say something that isn't true. Failing to disclose an unexpected material connection with an endorser, like you're paying them and not revealing it. Misrepresenting that the experience of endorsers represent the consumer's typical or ordinary experience. If it doesn't, you got to at least say it. All these are bad practices. All these are things you shouldn't do. You're deceiving the consumer. Deceptive packaging. Here we're in exaggerating packaging contents through subtle design, using misleading labels, for example, on foods, etc. You guys know these little small tomatoes you can buy, cherry tomatoes, in a store? So that doesn't look too bad. What's wrong with that? Looks okay. Looks healthy. It's all sealed up. Yay, let me have that. But when you open up the package, that's what you're actually getting. That's not very clear that that's what I'm getting. And notice that in addition, they have this nice cover on top you can't see down inside. So you can't really see this big hump in the middle. Where you aren't really getting any product there. That's not what it really looks like. I think you're trying to deceive your consumer. So when we engage in deceptive practices, we're just begging for legislation to occur. Fleischmann's yeast, way back in the day, a long time ago, claimed to do a bunch of health things, including claimed to straighten crooked teeth. Patently deceptive. A lie, and brought on legislation. It brought on the Widder-Lee Act of 1938 that gave the FTC power to regulate unfair or deceptive acts or practices. When you engage in unfair practices, you're asking for a law to be passed. Deceptive practices lead to fines. We've seen several. Apple, for example, agreed to pay $113 million to 34 states. You may have heard this story, for slowing down the batteries in their older iPhones. They used software to slow down the batteries. That was not good. Now we have the interesting question of puffery in marketing in this country, in the U.S., not necessarily true in Europe. We're allowed to do what's called puffery. Puffery is a legal term refers to promotional statements and claims that express subjective rather than objective views in a way that no reasonable person would take them literally. So I open up a coffee shop in Kent, like we need another coffee shop, Larry's Coffee Shop, and I say, come to Larry's Coffee Shop for the greatest cup of coffee in the world. Is that, and it isn't, is that deceptive? Or is it puffery? And why? It's deceptive. It's just a lie. It's puffery. Why is it puffery? Why is it puffery? You. It's subjective. I've tasted it, and I say it is the best cup of coffee in the world. It's not objective. Would a reasonable consumer believe that here in Kent, Ohio, Larry's Coffee is the best cup of coffee in the world? Probably a reasonable person wouldn't really believe that. It's puffery. So it's probably okay. I say, come to Larry's Coffee Shop in Kent, Ohio, for the cheapest cup of coffee in town. And it isn't. Puffery or deception? Deception. Why? It's objective, not subjective. You can see whether or not it's the cheapest. And could a reasonable person believe that somewhere in town there's the cheapest cup of coffee? Yes. Could it be Larry's? Yes. But it isn't. You're lying. Objectively lying. So in this country, puffery's okay under these rules. Deception is not. So you have to be aware of the kind of claim you're making and whether it's puffery or deception. Here's some pictures I took across the world. Crust 54, the best pizza in the city. Here's Follow This Truck for the best chopped liver in New York. Here's Ocean's Market, the best donuts on the beach. In each case, we could argue that if it isn't true, is at best puffery. Here's somebody in Gibraltar that was careful about how they phrased it. Probably the best fish and chips in Gibraltar. It's hard to argue with it. I mean, probably. So you're okay there, I guess, but they're also not in the U.S. So deceptive practices obviously harm businesses who are trying to compete against you, and you're not being honest. And obviously, we no longer subscribe to the idea it's the buyer's problem. Let the buyer beware. We have to be honest in our dealings so people aren't screwed. Can I say screwed? Aren't screwed by our marketing. Yes, sir.
I had a question on the puffery one.
Yep.
What about the thing that they always say, like, Red Bull gives you wings? Like, that one's, like...
Well, first of all, would most people believe that Red Bull gives you wings?
No.
Anybody here believe that Red Bull gives you wings? Anyone disappointed? That one person does. And that's... So, first of all, it's not a reasonable claim that anybody would believe, nor are they selling it that way, right? When I sell the cup of coffee being cheapest... I'm selling that. They aren't really selling anybody else. Sure, they. But I saw that guy get wings and fly around. Reasonable people understand it's not real. Okay? So it's not so much is it subjective or objective, but is it a reasonable claim? Am I getting to your point, or did I jump ahead? Yeah. So it's okay. It's puffery. It's having fun. It's humor. I don't know how that would run so it was a legitimate claim they were making, but it's not. So we understand it's not for real. So we don't want to engage in these things because it harms other businesses who are trying to compete against us, and it harms the buyers as well. High-pressure selling. Some salespeople are trained to deliver smooth, canned talks to entice purchase by consumers of products they don't need and don't really have a value. High-pressure selling persuades people to buy goods they have no intent of buying and no need to buy. It can occur for a variety of reasons. For example, because of prizing going to top sellers. We could argue that original Wells Fargo banking example was exactly this. Their bankers had incentives to open up these new accounts and had goals that they had to reach. And they were opening up consumers' accounts without telling them. That goes beyond just high-pressure selling, but also pushing people to open these accounts. This happens. There are some companies that train people to do this for real. Fortunately, it's not really a standard business practice of good organizations. Why? Well, in part, it's not good for long-term relationships. Hi, I sold you siding you didn't need. I sold you a roof you didn't need. Can I come back and sell you something else? No, you can't. Unsafe products, obviously not going to be a good thing. This includes products that aren't well made, services that are not done well, because when we talk about products, we mean services too. They include products that really don't deliver much benefit or that might even be harmful to the consumer. How does this occur? Well, we get unsafe products because the person, the company manufacturing, doesn't really care about it. So maybe they're out of country. They know that they're never going to see the consumer. Sometimes our product is just silly hard to make. It's very complex, so it's hard for us to get it done right. Sometimes we're paying labor poorly. We don't want to train them very well, and they end up creating unsafe products. Sometimes we have poor quality control. We're not paying attention to how the pieces and parts go together. And of course, sometimes they're just outright dishonest people creating unsafe products and selling them. None of this stuff is good. You guys have recall the Takata airbag problem, where the airbags in cars were just exploding on their own into people's faces? That was not good for Takata or the auto manufacturers. Walmart is regularly finding that some of its children's jewelry is made with toxic metals. You guys heard about these salmonella problems in the food supply chain? A while ago, peanut butter was found to have salmonella in it. Who is a local company that sells a lot of peanut butter? Nothing? Nobody? Yo. But is Jif, Smucker's is who I'm thinking. Are they the Jif one? Actually, I should know the brand. So Smucker's sells a lot of peanut butter. Their peanut butter was okay. But, say again? Their peanut butter was okay. But guess what happened to their sales? Because the competition's was full of salmonella, their sales went down too. Chipotle, you heard about Chipotle 2-3 years ago having to shut down and retrain their staff on how to avoid giving their customers salmonella poisoning. The Consumer Safety Product Commission tries to oversee this stuff. Their mission is to protect consumers against unreasonable risk of injury by developing voluntary and mandatory standards, by banning dangerous consumer products, by issuing recalls of products already on the market, and by researching potential hazards associated with consumer products. So you can actually go out to that website and see what they're all about. Fisher-Price, you would think Fisher-Price, at this stage of the game, knows what's going on. But they just, not too long ago, recalled 4.7 million rock and roll play sleepers because at least 8 kids died by being put down into this particular sleeper. And this is 2023. They can't figure this out. So there was a recall on their product. Not good.
As far as ethics to...
All right. I think I have 2 minutes and I won't run into our video. This will end the material on Mini-Test 3. I'll send you the exact pages after class. And Mini-Test 3 will open tomorrow at 8 and close next Tuesday. And Extra Credit will open tomorrow and close next Thursday. See you next time. Have a good weekend.